This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more details, see jodcast.net.
Okay, we're joined by Dr. Stephen Longmore of the Harvard Smithsonian Centre for Astrophysics in Boston, the US. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Yeah, thank you. Good to be here.
Now, you've been working on massive star formation.
That's right.
And you've been using something called the SMA. Tell us about that.
Yep, so the SMA is a submillimeter array. It's a 8 times 6 meter antenna observing simultaneously. So these 8 antenna or dishes are spread over a large area, up to 0.5 kilometer apart. And they, by combining the signals, it acts like a giant antenna of that size, so 0.5 kilometer. Now, it's very difficult and extremely expensive to build one dish or one antenna this size, but by combining the signals, we can do that. And this gives a fantastic resolution, so we can see the regions I'm looking at in exquisite detail.
Okay, and you said this is in submillimeter, and I think it's on the top of Mauna Kea?
That's right, yeah. So its location on the top of Mauna Kea gives it some very, very good advantages. By being at 4,000 meters or 14,000 feet, it's above most of the water vapor in the atmosphere. And this gives it access to much of the electromagnetic spectrum that is not accessible from sea level. And the SMA is the only interferometer that's working in this, what's called the submillimeter wavelength regime.
Right, and submillimeter is about 600,000 times longer than optical wavelengths that we're used to seeing with our eyes.
That's right, much, much longer wavelength. So this is great because in this regime, the submillimeter regime, you see light from very cold gas and dust. And this very cold gas and dust is emitted from objects, many objects, when they form. So, for example, planets and stars and even galaxies emit light in this submillimeter regime. Mm. So it's a very powerful window if you can get access to it, but it's difficult, which is why you need to put it on top of a mountain to be able to see it.
So tell us about the sort of things you've been looking at with the SMA.
Well, I've been looking at massive star formation regions. Massive stars are very important in the observable universe. They're actually a bit like James Dean. They're very rare. They live fast. They die young. But in that short lifespan, they exert a huge influence on their surroundings. So, for example, over the course of their lifetime, they inject as much energy into their surroundings as a supernova. And then just to make matters worse, they then die as supernova. And so they really obliterate their surroundings.
Right. So if you were to look at an image of a galaxy, which contains about 100 billion stars, say, then they would be taking up quite a large amount of that galaxy.
Well, if you look at a galaxy that's forming stars, if you were to look at the spectral energy distribution, so to say, where's the bulk of the energy in this galaxy coming out, that would be dominated by the massive stars.
Right.
Because they're so rare and short-lived, they're really difficult to find and study. So as a result, compared to our understanding of how the lower mass stars form, the evolution is really quite poorly understood how they actually evolve. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to understand how these massive stars form because they play such a pivotal role in the evolution of our universe.
So how do you go about finding out these details?
Very good question. Well, we start from what we do know. That's always a good place to start. So we know that that massive stars form in these very massive, cold, dense molecular clouds. So these things can have up to 100,000 times the mass, or even 1 million times the mass of our sun.
And what sort of things are these molecular clouds made of?
It's the bulk of it is molecular hydrogen, actually, which is slightly annoying because we can't see it. you have to use other ways of looking at it because you can't see this molecular hydrogen directly. But we can infer it's there. For example, if you live in the southern hemisphere and you go out of a night time and you see these dark bands across the Milky Way, that's dust. So it's cold. We can see that these things are there because they block the starlight. There's so much gas and dust in these things that they block the light from background stars. So that's how one way we can tell that they're there. And we know that the stars form inside these giant molecular clouds. If they get large enough and dense enough and cold enough, then they can collapse under their own gravity. And once they get dense enough for nuclear burning to switch on, then stars can form. So what we really want to know, the kind of question I'm really trying to get at is, well, we've got these giant molecular clouds and we see that there's massive stars that exist. We want to know, given the conditions of these giant molecular clouds, how many stars of different masses will come out, because the ratio of the number of low mass stars to high mass stars determines how the subsequent evolution of the galaxy, how that will proceed. If you've got lots of massive stars, then it's going to be very disruptive, and if you've got fewer massive stars, then it's going to be quieter.
What does low mass and high mass mean for stars compared to, say,
excellent
our
question.
Sun?
Yep. So there's a cutoff at around 8 times the mass of our own sun, so 8 solar masses. Stars larger than that, they're different in many ways. Well, first of all, they will die as supernova. So a star of greater than 8 solar masses will die as supernova. They also have enough UV or ultraviolet radiation that they can ionize their surrounding.
So that's they split the electrons off from the atoms.
Exactly right. So they have enough of these very high energy photons emitted that they can begin to ionize or dissociate the surrounding molecular gas. So yeah, they're special for a number of reasons.
Right. And a low mass star, I guess, is something more like the sun then.
Yeah, the sun's a very typical star. Anything less than 8 solar masses, but as you get to smaller and smaller masses, you get more and more stars. So the sun is a very typical star.
And you're saying that about the different models which produce different distributions of high mass stars, lots of times the mass of the sun, or low mass stars. Can you tell us about those different models?
Yeah, so there's different theoretical models which try and understand this problem. So you've got the initial conditions, these giant molecular clouds, and the difference between these models is how the gas collapses and fragments. So you can imagine that in the first model, mm-hmm, everything initially collapses down to small objects of about the mass of the sun. But then objects are forming over dense regions. So there's lots of these objects of a solar
lots
mass.
Lots of small sun-sized
yep,
things.
Lots of small sun mass things. Then they will have a deeper gravitational potential. So they can attract more matter. So more matter will fall onto them.
Right, so they attract the small
more, yep,
blobs of stuff.
Yes, exactly. And all the gas that's not in these blobs falls onto them, so that they grow more than those that are formed in isolation, because they can't attract as much matter. So in that model, everything starts small, and if you're lucky to be born in a very dense region, then you get more matter. Whereas if you're unlucky enough to be born in an isolated region, you stay small. So that model proceeds over time. So your mass is dependent on where you're born, basically. Whereas in the other model, it's more of a static model, where the clumps, for one reason or another, are born with a different size. And then if you're born in a big clump, then you form a big star. And if you're born in a small clump, you form a small star. But it doesn't depend on where you are in relation to anything else. It's just how big you are to start off with.
Right. So it's almost like in biology, when you've got the difference between nature and nurture. This is something that changes with your lifetime as a star.
That's an excellent way of describing it, yeah.
So the other way is genetics. It's what you start with and it defines
who
you are.
Yeah, so in the second model, it's what you start with defines what you're going to end up as with the star. Whereas in the first one, it's what's around you, what your environment is, that's going to determine where you end
up. So how do you go about starting to distinguish between which of these two models might be the right one to describe massive star formation?
What you have to do is you have to know the age of your objects, or at least their relative age. Even though these things are very fast-lived, so they form in 10,000 years or so, 10 to 5 years.
That's very quick for astronomy.
It's very quick for astronomy. It's like, I don't know, they're like popcorn in galaxies if you look at them in the
right,
sort of lifetimes of galaxies. So you need to be very, very lucky to catch them, or you need to look very hard to get them. So what we first of all do is separate them out into age. We get them when they're very young, before they've formed any stars, and then we separate them out in age and try and follow how this gas is collapsing. And you can imagine if you look young enough and you see lots of things of about the same size, then that would favour the nurture.
Right,
model,
so they,
as you
they
said.
Bring, because there's so many of them together, they bring more gas in.
Yep, that's right. Whereas if you find the opposite, that you find objects of different masses, then the latter one looks like it's more favourable. So the idea is to look at, to do this statistically, and so look at lots of objects and see which model is more favourable.
Okay, and you've been doing that?
Yeah, so using the SMA, we've done it for a small number of objects. We've done it with 6 objects, and have been trying to compare them.
How does that pan out then? Have you got any ideas which model might be right from those results?
We're working on it. It's work in progress.
Right.
From the initial data, it looked as if we were seeing many objects of the same size. But we have to be careful when we're looking at this, because there are many, the devil's in the detail, as they say. So, we're working on it.
All right. Well, very good. We wish you the best of luck with those observations, and I hope you get some more, and I hope it sheds light on which of these models might be right.
Yes, I'll keep you posted.
Thank you for talking
to us. Wonderful. Thanks for having me.